Anthropology College of Staten Island and also at the CUNY Graduate Center here in Manhattan. Happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. Tune in tomorrow to our tribute to the blacklisted lyricist Yip Harburg, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, his song sung by millions around the world. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. This news is funded by viewers and listeners like you. Please support our work at democracynow.org/support.
Abstinence means not having sex, right? But what is sex? An intercourse? And what the heck is outer course? Well, people define sex, abstinence, and outer course in different ways. For some people, abstinence means not doing any kind of fooling around. No oral sex, vaginal sex, anal sex, nothing. They're abstaining from it all. Not only does this type of abstinence do a great job of preventing pregnancy, it's 100% effective, it also guarantees you won't get a sexually transmitted infection. For some other people, abstinence means not having vaginal intercourse. They do the other stuff, just not the thing that can lead to a pregnancy. All that other stuff is what we mean by outer course. Outer course is sex play without the penetration. It's like intercourse without the inner... you get it. Kissing, touching, grinding, massage, masturbation, sex talk, all of that can be lumped into what's called outer course. Outer course is also a great method of birth control. As long as no sperm get in the vagina, there's no risk of pregnancy. And if you avoid vaginal, anal, and oral sex, you reduce your risk for sexually transmitted infections as well. Like all methods of birth control, abstinence and outer course are more effective the longer and better you use them. They require determination, self-control, trust, and good communication. It also helps to know about other ways to protect yourself from unintended pregnancy and STDs, just in case you decide to have intercourse. If you'd like to learn more about outer course and abstinence, you should check out PlannedParenthood.org. If you're a teen, you might want to look into Teen Talk. There's tons of information and discussions.
And you are listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM, as well as over the internet at WUSB.FM. It's Tuesday evening, time once again for Off the Wall. a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Buenas noches. Feliz Navidad. Navidad.
Yeah, that's it's Christmas Eve. It's yeah, boy, look at that. How did that happen? And for some reason, we have a bunch of flowers in the studio that are separating us. I can just barely see you. It's like I'm looking through a jungle.
Yes, peering. But I'm good to go on this side if you are ready.
I think so. Careful, though. Those things are...
Okay, yeah, they're now heavy. You're completely obscured.
These gigantic lilies, and they're opening up, and they're really kind of like, you know, lost in space looking and scary.
The pods have emerged, have opened.
I don't think we've ever done a Christmas Eve show before. We might have. We might have. You know, it's all blurring for me, but it's Christmas Eve right now. That's a fact. In case you didn't know that, and I guess people are outside or inside preparing, doing whatnot. We had very cold weather up until now. It's still cold, but it's not cold enough as far as I'm concerned. It was well below freezing, unfortunately very dry. We got a little bit of snow, sprinkling, and there's a chance we might get a little bit of snow for Christmas, which would be nice, but probably negligible, if any. But fingers crossed for the rest of the winter. Maybe we'll have one this year. Who knows? All right, well, you know, it being Christmas Eve and all, we're going to devote the entire program to messages of peace and love. And if you believe that for one second, boy, you haven't listened to this show for very long, have you? No, the world continues with its unabashed descent into chaos and tragedy. And we're here to kind of... peer into that that cesspool of hell.
Morass.
That's a good word. That's a good word. I don't know how to use it properly, but yes, definitely where applicable. We should just use better words next year. I think in 1 week it'll be New Year's Eve and we can start making all kinds of resolutions on things we can do better next year.
Yeah, a lot of technology comes with dictionaries now.
You know, do you want to say something about what you did, what you've been working with? Because I was so impressed by that.
Well, it's just like an alternate e-ink tablet. I don't really have any other tablets.
You can say what it's called.
No.
Okay, I don't know what it's called. I forget. It's one of those made up words like Roku or Booby or I don't know. People just keep making up things because all the words are taken.
Well, and like the parent company is like another weird word. It's like. It's actually a Kobo.
Yeah, you said it. Said it. Wow.
But they have a lot of different ones.
I wasn't far off. Kobo.
I'm not sure what people are gifting others for the holidays and stuff, but this was something that came highly recommended from our friend Greg Newby.
Greg Newby.
Who was sharing his experience with it, and I really enjoy it. It's a cool device if you're not using sort of the mainstream e-readers or tablets, if you don't have any other tablet. Mm-hmm. And basically, I wanted to get my my digital reading up, and you know, I like reading a good hard copy of a book, but I also, you know, want to explore that whole territory and When I do a lot of you know, looking at our own publishing, like and experimenting with all of the cool things that are going on with people expressing themselves and, you know, sharing different forms of media, like this was something I just fell behind on. I feel like digital music was the same way because it just started in one way and then fragmented and then, you know, there were big players getting involved and books have been the same way. So I was playing around with it and I was playing around with the dictionary, all the dictionaries. You can do all kinds of stuff like that.
How does the dictionary fit into all this?
Well, if you're reading something, it's really handy. Like if you don't know a word.
So wait, you're reading something and you come upon a word and what do? You click on the word?
Well, I haven't gotten that far, but you can also just type in a word that you don't know. I presume you could maybe like paste it.
Uh-huh. So it's like reading, you know, the works of William Shakespeare and you have Webster's right next to you for when you come upon those words that you don't understand what they are or never heard before.
Correct.
But it's all in one little device.
Yeah. And there's really incredible projects like Project Gutenberg that where you can get like free publications and stuff that is in the public domain, stuff that you should maybe have already read or maybe you read it in school, but you never kept the copy that you read. Mm-hmm. So you want to have a digital copy of something to go back and maybe refer to it, see how you might hear some of the words in a different light.
But isn't it possible that Amazon could just take back the books that you're reading on this device?
Well, I haven't gone that far because this company has their own sort of like profiles and stuff, as you have to do with everything. Like, you have to sort of manage it with some kind of account or at least some kind of communication or authentication method, like an email address.
I'm confused. Are you saying Amazon has no connection to this?
No, they're not a part of this.
Mercy. Wow. Okay. Great. Yeah. Whoa. that's amazing.
Well, it's unusual. Sometimes, like, these larger companies have kind of a dominant edge on certain things, but it's cool to see the technology implemented by other brands. Mm-hmm. And I just am interested in, I don't know, I've been learning more about the capabilities of all this stuff, and it's vastly more capable than, like, early, say, like, the first generation of Kindles or, like, your early tablets of different brands and varieties.
It sounds like it's better than the later ones, too, not just the early ones, but I guess that's for the consumer to decide.
They're wildly more capable and incredibly small, mm-hmm. and just certain things like the ability to have like an e-ink display or backlighting on a digital device instead of looking at like screens a lot or like having wider screens. Again, this is like to improve your digital experience, much in the way people like curated their digital music. So anyway, I had a good experience just playing around with that, but that's what made me think of the dictionary.
Well, that's awesome. And curating digital material is something that I think we embrace, but also we embrace the analog in addition, you know, because we collect books, we collect records, we collect films, well, not film, reels of film, but, you know, videotapes and things like that. It's good to hold on to the originals, the original works as they came out before they became digitized.
You've been doing a lot of that. Isn't it remarkable how when you get a collection, you're just looking at the totality of it,
mm-hmm.
in modern terms. And it's quite a lot of information. I know we look at this stuff and just moving it around and keeping it straight and not having duplicates, all of that is a full-time endeavor, but
yeah,
well, it's amazing. And then to think like in a couple of years, it will just, you know, fit on something the size of your fingernail.
It's, you know, eventually it's going to fit into just air, nothing at all, because it just keeps getting smaller and smaller. What I've been working on actually for a long, long time is a videotape collection. I used to just record TV, you know, 6 hours of TV, maybe 8 hours of TV, depending on the cassette. You know, my favorite programs, but also I'd record all the commercials and newscasts and history and things like that. And in the end, I have about 1,900 tapes. 1,900 tapes, each one of which is around 6 or 8 hours long. And it took a while, but we were able to digitize all of that and make each tape into a file, huge file. And now being able to collect all that together and back it up onto LTO tapes, you know, my entire collection I can hold in my hand. And of course, it can get even smaller than that when you introduce flash drives. And the technology will just keep getting smaller and smaller. You know, I was amazed when I could fit TV shows on a videotape. I thought that was really cool. But it's gone from being two bookcases, you know, going from the floor to the ceiling, to basically a bunch of files on a computer, to something I can hold in my hand, to something I could probably swallow in the future. So, yeah, the size has stopped amazing me because I'm just resigned to the fact that it's going to keep getting smaller and smaller. I want to do something with the content. I want to be able to share the content. I want to be able to find these unique little bits of broadcasting that have been forgotten and lost. And that's the next step, is to have some kind of a system set up where I can easily input a number of hours of video, find cool things and upload them someplace and share them. People can look it over themselves and say, hey, I was in that commercial, you know, things like that. It's all there. It's all been preserved. And, you know, people can do the same thing with their photo albums, with their cassette collection, even their 8-track collection. Sure, why not? reel-to-reel tapes, 8mm film. There is so much. So, you know, it's great to hold on to the originals, but they do deteriorate. And it's good to have fresh copies as well. But on that note, the digital copies, they tend to disappear quicker than the analog copies. And, you know, look at old books, for instance, from, you know, the early part of the 20th century or even the 19th century. They're still around. And, you know, people who digitize things, they sometimes lose their files in you know, a couple of years. And if you bank on that as being the only source left, guaranteed that source will be lost without holding on to the originals in whatever form they are.
Yeah. Yeah. So always a constant process. I think that's the best mode because it's there's new things and there's always new formats and ways to explore it and organize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun. It's satisfying because you realize that all these things still exist. You can refer back to them. You can compare them to the present day, and you know, not just have them filed away in a basement someplace waiting to be flooded.
So, is there anything going on or some stuff you wanted to talk about tonight?
Well, other it's not
than indoor winter projects.
Yeah, it's not stuff I want to talk about, but it's stuff I kind of have to talk about.
Well, I think I'm ready.
Yeah,
I'll just sit back. Actually,
we heard about what happened in Magdeburg last week. The horrible car plowing into a Christmas village. It seems to be almost tradition in Germany for this to happen. And, you know, it's interesting. We went to Magdeburg almost at random a few years ago, where we wanted to stay in a part of Germany that wasn't, you know, a big major city we had heard of before, you know, one of the smaller cities. And we had a great time there. It was a very nice place. So it was really dismaying to hear that this this horrible thing happened. But the story itself is really a pretty bizarre one, because what's happened is it turns out the person who was behind all this was a 50-year-old refugee from Saudi Arabia who worked as a doctor and called himself a women's rights activist, but he was very anti-Islam and a proponent of the far-right Alternative for Germany, you know, one of these right-wing fascist groups. In fact, Elon Musk has endorsed them as the only party that could save Germany. He is the guy who did this is one of those hate mongers, one of those far right extremists. And what everyone seems to be latching upon instead of that is the fact that he's from a foreign country, you know, that he wasn't born in Germany. Okay, regardless of where he was born, he is one of these far right extremists. I mean, he has said so himself. His writings indicate this. And yet what's happening? The group that he endorsed is holding rallies and gaining support. One of their people did this, and they are gaining support by being anti-immigrant. You know, the fact that he was from Saudi Arabia, that doesn't really enter into it. The fact that he was filled with hatred, the same kind of hatred that this organization has and spreads, that is a lot more relevant. That's the key right there. Okay? He had all kinds of warning signs. He was saying all kinds of dark, sinister things. And they're not focusing on that. They're focusing on the fact that he was a foreigner. Yeah. It's really disturbing. And, you know, you think that your country is the only one that can be fooled, and you realize this is happening all over the world. Look, I'm reading from this story that came from Politico. It remains unclear whether the attack will ultimately benefit the AfD, which is now polling in second place behind Germany's Conservative Alliance, given the attacker's apparent sympathy with the party. Now, previous attacks by Islamists, which included a knife attack in the western city of Solingen last August, they boosted the far-right party in the polls. Horrible as that is, you can see the logic at least. If they preach hatred towards anyone who's foreign, and someone who's foreign does this, you could sort of see how they could gain support from that. But if somebody does this that is basically saying the same things and even supporting that particular group, does it make any sense that they would benefit from that? Or would people rise up and say, what kind of people are you inspiring? You have to take some responsibility for this. Well, despite the facts, the AfD intends to use the incident to double down on its anti-immigration message and to attack German mainstream politicians on the issue of domestic security. Now, Germany's economy minister, chancellor candidate for the Greens, Robert Habeck, pushed back against Elon Musk and his endorsement of these killers. They are killers. You inspire killers. You wear the title as well, I think. He said, don't believe what propagandists on the net want to tell you. Their lies are faster than the truth. This is especially true now before the election. Mistrust is being stirred up with power, the power of the big social media platforms, and increasingly with big money. And if that's not aimed directly at Elon Musk, I don't know what is. So we're seeing a lot of ugliness here. We're seeing a lot of misinformation, disinformation being spread around. And it's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better.
Oh, yeah. I think the vigilance and, good reporting on what all is taking place in these emergent sorts of transformations.
Yep. All right. Well, that's only one. That's only one thing that's happened. All kinds of other things are going on. And yeah, we do have to focus on them a little bit. We got our friend, New York City Mayor Eric Adams. You know, I don't like to use the show to say I told you so, but I told everybody. Okay, when he was running in the primary, there were progressive candidates that were well qualified. They laid out their positions very clearly. There were all sorts of other candidates. And who did he can't even blame the Republicans because the Democrats had full control here. It was a Democratic primary. And it was well understood that whoever won the Democratic primary would win the election. No question about that. So the Democrats, not the party, the people in New York City had the ability to pick the next mayor of New York City out of a field of about half a dozen people, at least two of which were respectable progressive candidates. And who did they go with? They went with the ex-cop. Yeah. And now, you reap what you sow. Okay, he's now calling Donald Trump a great patriot. He's criticizing Joe Biden. He's praising Elon Musk. He's accusing the Justice Department of political vendettas against enemies. He's gotten a hero's welcome on Fox News. He's welcomed some of Trump's hardline immigration threats. And he's dared foes on the political left to cancel him. Checkmate. That's what happens when you go with your emotions and you don't think things through logically. Democrats elected him. They endorsed him. And now, fortunately, next year is election year in New York City. Hopefully they can undo the damage. But he's acting just like a MAGA Republican. He absolutely is. He used to brand himself the Biden of Brooklyn, but he's basically turned up the dial with his defense of Trump, especially since September. Remember what happened in September? Adams was indicted on corruption charges in Manhattan federal court. Yeah. So now you have two people who have been indicted for multiple crimes defending each other because, Trump is saying good things about Adams now, too. Now, in a way, I could sort of see why Adams would do this as mayor, and you might see this from other people as well. Yeah. Praise the guy, be on his good side, because that way he can't do too many terrible things to your city. I was willing to consider that, but there's just too much here, and there's too much of a personal interest as well, since he could be somebody who could face substantial penalties, maybe even prison. And being on Trump's good side, and and basically comparing himself to all the court cases that Trump has been involved with, all the criminal charges, that is something that I think he is selfishly applying here. So, that's something to wonder about. What's going to happen in New York City over the next at least year? And who will they get to replace Adams? I know a number of people are interested in the job, but boy, this is... I can't say it's surprising. It's just really distressing. Now, while all this is going on, Trump continues to name what, according to The Guardian, is stunningly unqualified people for the diplomatic team. I mean, I don't really know how much damage you can do to the Bahamas, but having Herschel Walker as the ambassador to the Bahamas, I guess we're going to find out, because boy, I mean, that guy is, he's got to be the most unqualified person ever to be nominated for anything. You know, he had unsuccessful political campaign just last year. Now he's being placed as somebody who will be the ambassador to the Bahamas. The posting in Paris went to Charles Kushner, who is the father of Trump's son-in-law, and a man that Trump once pardoned for a felony conviction that former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie called one of the most loathsome, disgusting crimes he ever prosecuted. Yeah, it is one big soap opera out there. Greece, who do they get? They get... Donald Trump Jr.'s fiance, Kimberly Guilfoyle, you know, the woman with the lungs who can basically, scare an entire field of cows, but with her bellowing. It just goes on, and it's not just ambassadors; it's people heading agencies. It's a comedy show in some ways, but it's also a Shakespearean tragedy. Because what are these people going to wind up doing or undoing in the future, very near future? Then you've got all kinds of proclamations. For some reason, Trump is still having rallies. I guess he just likes to have rallies. That's what dictators do. They have rallies, and this isn't going to end anytime soon. But now he's getting a little bit more unhinged. He's starting to threaten allies. And one of them is Denmark. he has announced his intention to acquire Greenland one way or another. I couldn't even make this up if I tried. But just today, I think it was today. It was yesterday. The Danish government announced a huge boost in defense spending for Greenland. That was mere hours after Trump repeated his desire to obtain the Arctic territory. Danish Defense Minister Troels Lund Poulsen said the package was a double-digit billion account in krone, which is at least 1.5 billion U.S. dollars. Now, they're not saying that this announcement has anything to do with what Trump said. In fact, they're calling it an irony of fate that it happened right after Trump said that obtaining Greenland is an absolute necessity for the United States. Now, Greenland, if you don't know, it's an autonomous Danish territory. It's home to a large U.S. space facility. It's strategically important to the U.S. It's basically on its shortest route to Europe, has major mineral and oil reserves. That is something that kind of shocked the world when Trump said this. It doesn't end there, though. He also said that... we intend to reclaim the Panama Canal. You know, take the Panama Canal from Panama. It's in the name. Panama Canal belongs to Panama, you know? And they are not going to give it up. And Trump apparently feels that he can just take whatever he wants. And, you know, I can't really blame him for feeling that way because nobody has ever stopped him before. You know, he always gets whatever he wants. And everybody bows down to him and makes all kinds of excuses and just thinks of their own bottom line as far as, is this good for me or not? So Yeah, that's just the first two. Who knows what else is festering in his mind. But I'll tell you this, you know, I will volunteer to be in the Greenland Defense Forces. I will volunteer to be in the Panamanian, whatever they have, because this is not acceptable. This is not what my country is all about, invading friends or taking property that does not belong to us. Yeah, I know it's part of our tradition, but this, I feel this is kind of like a line that we can't cross. But we'll see. We'll see how people react to this. Or maybe he'll just forget about it by January 20th.
I have nothing else to contribute.
Well, contribute something while I sip the coffee that I'm holding in my
hands.
Oh,
the coffee. Yeah. No, it's
the only chance I have.
Chaotic and, I guess, disappointing. But, yeah, I don't really have any other comment. I mean, I what am I going to contribute to this, really? I honestly think a lot of this is just meant to get people riled up, you know?
But they elected him. We're already riled up. What's the purpose of riling us up even more?
All right. Well, I'm not going to share if I'm going to be picked apart
either. No, it's a question. Okay, I'll shut up. I'll sip some more coffee.
Well, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't really feel like defending what I really think it is, so I'm not going to share. I mean, I've talked so much about why this was all a bad idea, and here we are, like, why do I have to figure out what the next bad idea is? I mean, I'm not going to... Me characterizing it isn't going to do me much good. I hope it's comforting for those of you, you know, sipping your nog and stuff.
Why don't we have any of that? It's Christmas Eve. We don't have any eggnog. My goodness. Canada. That's what I was trying to remember. He's sort of threatening to invade Canada, too. So all you Canadian people out there, I'm going to volunteer to join your military as well and just stop this guy, whatever it takes. I'll feed you intelligence. I will. I know these words are going to come back to haunt me someday in court, but I don't care. You know, this is wrong. These are our friends. You don't threaten our friends. They haven't done anything bad to us. And, you know, I'm just kind of sick of stupidity.
What even are friends anymore?
Well, I don't know. They won't be friends for long. Okay, so Biden yesterday commuted all these death row sentences. Was it yesterday or a couple of days ago? You know, I never know timing-wise. But yeah, 37 to 40 federal death row inmates have had their sentences of death commuted, you know, changed to life in prison. Now, you know, I'm reading a story here from the BBC. Normally, BBC is pretty fair. But boy, do they give undue attention to the Republican reaction here. Biden's move was swiftly condemned by Republicans, with some accusing the president of siding with criminals over law-abiding Americans because we're not killing them. That's now the definition of siding with criminals, just not killing them. You know, we used to have no death penalty. We used to be anti-death penalty. We used to be trying to eliminate the death penalty. And now, if you don't embrace the death penalty, you're siding with the criminals. Continuing, federal executions were relatively rare before Trump's first term in office. Yeah, relatively rare before Trump's first term in office. Remember, Timothy McVeigh was one of the rare exceptions. But Trump's first term in office finished with a flurry of executions that ended a 130-year-old precedent of pausing executions amid a presidential transition. Yeah, we forget about that, don't we? Trump has vowed to continue killing people or resume killing people when he returns to the White House in January. Yeah, I phrased it a little differently, but it's basically the same thing. Setting the stage for possible legal battles early in the administration. Only three inmates were left to face the death penalty, and they are probably people that Trump would spare, such as Robert Bowers, who killed 11 worshipers and wounded seven during a shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018. Dylan Roof, who in 2017 conducted a mass shooting that left nine black parishioners dead at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. That's in 2015. He was sentenced to death in 2017. And the Boston Marathon bomber. Those are the three that were not spared the death penalty. So, yeah. While the move was widely praised by human rights activists such as Amnesty International, and that's pretty much the only thing said in favor of it, It was quickly condemned by some Republicans, as well as Trump's transition team and political allies. And the whole rest of the article is just quotes from people condemning Biden for not thinking about the families. It used to be that, you know, you catch the criminal and you put them away and that was sufficient. But now if you don't kill them, then it's all of a sudden you're part of the problem. So, you know, there's definitely been a shift in the way the country handles this kind of thing. And I just expected more from the BBC.
Ouch.
Yeah. So there's that. And, you know, Trump is really eager to put as many people on death row as possible. It's going to be a bit scary. He has vowed to resume federal executions, make more people eligible to receive the death penalty. terrible, terrible, horrible people are responsible for death, carnage, and crime all over the country. So, you know, you notice how crime was just interjected there. Just crime. Doesn't have to be death, doesn't have to be carnage, but just crime. We're going to be asking everyone who sells drugs and gets caught to receive the death penalty for their heinous acts. Selling drugs now. Yeah.
So, E?
Oh, boy, this is...
Okay.
I'm reading.
I'll defend this.
Seeing what I qualify for here.
What is it wrong... Or let's, I don't know if I'm even asking something, but like, what if I'm not alarmed and like, I'm just like, okay, sure. Go for it. You know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, resisting has been great and I think, you know, served a lot of purposes, but you're sharing this and here it is. We're supposed to put our eggnog down.
I don't have any eggnog.
Oh.
That's the problem. I need spiked eggnog right away, or I'm not going to make it through the night. So let's work on that.
I'm not, I mean, maybe it sounds cynical, but if I'm being 100% serious on any one of these things when it comes up, and I'm just like, sure, do it, big guy, yeah.
I kind of feel like that's what the country said in November. It's like, fine, go ahead. Let's see what happens. And now we're going to see what happens.
It's like he's stoking a reaction, in my opinion, and like wanting to see resistance or anything. And I think collectively people are just mirroring that. And I feel I'm almost, I don't know, it's not apathy. And I don't think it's cynicism. It's just like, yeah, let's see what happens. See the reaction. You know, go for it. Panama. Take Greenland. Take whatever. Take the whole world.
Here's the thing.
Disassemble everything.
Here's the thing, Kyle.
Fine.
Countries and people change. And what was abnormal one day becomes normal the next. What I was referring to before about the way people are responding to the possibility of death penalty. Now it's assumed that certain people will just get the death penalty as opposed to earlier where death penalty is not something a civilized country should have, period. Used to be most people believe that. That's not the case anymore. So if we normalize this, if we just allow it to happen, then it just becomes something we don't react to at all anymore, becomes normalized. And that's what worries me, is that we're letting too many things become normalized and... You know, that's why I object every time I see, you know, one of these media outlets treating Trump with respect that he does not deserve. Yeah, if you're a far right broadcaster, I get it. You know, that's who you are. But anyone else who has been railing against the threat to democracy over the past several years to suddenly fall into line now and say, well, he was elected, we have to treat him with respect. No, you don't. Respect is earned. He has not earned anything. All right. And everything that he does, you need to speak up and challenge and get the actual facts and not just accept what you're told. And that's not just the media. That's all of us. We all have to do that. We all have to stand up and get in the way. And I sure hope we see that in 2025, or I don't know what 2026 will possibly bring us. But you know what? I'm going to shift gears. You know, I don't want to bash Trump for the whole hour. He doesn't deserve it. no, he doesn't deserve the time. He deserves the bashing. But let's focus on Governor Hochul, a Democrat. Yeah, I can do that. And what she's been doing over the last couple of weeks. You know, she vetoed a bill that banned the harvesting of horseshoe crabs. Yeah, this was about a week ago. She vetoed legislation that would have banned the harvesting of horseshoe crabs as bait or for biomedical purposes, in a move applauded by Long Island fishermen, because, boy, they're the people that we should always consult first, as Long Island fishermen, criticized by scientists as disappointing. And a couple other words I can't say on the air. Horseshoe crabs are used by around a dozen... Are you kidding me? Horseshoe crabs are used by a dozen fishermen in waterways around Long Island. 12 people? That's it? Okay, they set traps for eels and whelk, which are the snail-like creatures also known as conch. The bill also would have banned their use for biomedical purposes, though such uses have been limited in New York. Yeah, why in God's name did she do this? Okay, here's what she said. While this bill is well-intentioned, the management of marine species is better left to the experts at the State Department of Environmental Conservation. She urged the state legislature to restore DEC's specific authority to regulate crabs and directed the agency to review and implement further administrative measures to protect this species using its broad authority to protect and regulate marine resources. Okay. I don't know why they don't have that authority. Maybe she can just give them that authority and they can do this? This just seems like we're being caught in some kind of bureaucratic a trap here. And this species, which is becoming increasingly rare and cannot be found in many parts of the planet, needs to be protected, period. That should be the priority. All right. Here's something else that Governor Hochul vetoed. She vetoed a bill to restore state recognition for the tribe known as Montaukettes. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Yeah, Governor Hochul, again, this is not the first time. She has vetoed legislation that would have reinstated the Montaukette Indian Nation's state recognition, drawing the wrath of tribal leaders and the bill's sponsor, who criticized the governor as on the wrong side of history once again. One Montaukette leader said the governor's staff in recent days had raised concerns about potential land claims by the nation, even though the Montaukettes have never broached such claims and the issue hadn't been raised through months of negotiations. I'm extremely disappointed in how this matter was handled by the governor's office, said Sandy Brewster Walker, the nation's executive director. It's hard for me to believe anything that the governor says. They have disrespected the nation and seem to be looking for reasons not to recognize us. Hochul, in a veto statement on Saturday, said she was constrained to veto the bill because the Montaukette Nation has not yet demonstrated that they meet the requirements necessary for recognition. That's a different reason than they previously gave, than Hochul previously gave to the tribe, saying as of Friday night that officials had concerns about the potential for Montaukette land claims. The state legislature earlier this year unanimously approved the bill, which asserts that the nation's prior state recognition was improperly removed in a widely criticized 1910 court decision by a state judge who did not have the authority to remove it. Unanimous. And again, you know, I've brought this up in the past when she vetoed this, I think last year. How come the state legislature and the state Senate won't override the veto if the vote was unanimous? I don't understand why this is the case. I've asked around. Nobody gets it. Nobody understands what's going on here. But there's some kind of a weird dance involving the governor and the state legislature and the state Senate that assures this bill will never pass. Assemblyman Fred Thiel, Democrat of Sag Harbor, who has sponsored iterations of the bill under Hochul and under former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who also has vetoed this, and that's over the past 10 years, he said he was notified of the veto by Hochul's office on Saturday morning. after meetings with her staff late this week. Both Hochul and Cuomo have vetoed this legislation, get this, 3 times each. And Athiel said in some ways this was the worst veto of them all because the governor's office engaged with the Montaukets through 2024 and up until Friday night. Tribal leaders spent tens, maybe hundreds of hours providing Hochul's office with requested documentation and information, all for naught. The tribe had been given a lot of encouragement to work with them, and at the very end, they just pulled the rug out, they referring to Hochul's office. I can't emphasize how badly the governor's office has treated the Montaukets this past year. Yeah, it's sad. And it doesn't end there. This is a different cast of characters, but the Shinnecock Indian Nation out Southampton ways, well, they're being sued by the town of Southampton. Yeah, they filed suit against the trustees of the Shinnecock Indian Nation this past Friday. Yeah, not a good week for Indian Nations on the island. And this lawsuit is over the construction of a 10-acre gas station and travel plaza in Hampton Bays. Southampton argues that it creates a public nuisance that violates zoning ordinances as well as state and local laws. You know, ordinarily, I probably agree with that. I'd probably say, yeah, we don't need another gas station. We don't need another travel plaza. But here's the thing. It's not your land. It's not Southampton's land. It belongs to the Shinnecock Indian Nation. So, you know, you might as well go over to Spain and start telling them where they can build and where they can't build, because you have just as much authority there as you do here. But the fact that they're filing suit anyway, it just shows you what they really think. The Shinnecock Nation, the Council of Trustees, have said they are going to fight the suit. We're back in this situation where the town has come against the Shinnecock Nation and basically declared war against us, said Lance Gums, vice chairman of the Shinnecock Council of Trustees. He said, we won't stop construction. We will continue construction. The town does not have any jurisdiction over our tribal lands whatsoever. And tribal leaders have said that the development would create a crucial revenue stream for the tribe. It's going to provide stability for our nation, for our organization to just function, Trustee Bianca Collins said to Newsday back in March. The town, however, charges that the Sunrise Highway Travel Plaza, which is to include a 20-bay gas station and smoke shop, is the first phase of a resort construction project that would dramatically change the character of the area, clearing large wooded areas abutting private homes and overburdening the roadways with increased traffic. Again, normally I'd agree. But they have no jurisdiction. They don't seem to understand that. The Shinnecock trustees, acting on behalf of the nation, never sought permission to clear the land or install underground tanks for the travel plaza, the suit claims. Well, it's interesting. I didn't know you had to ask permission for people who have no authority over you. But I guess the law is mysterious. In August, according to court papers, a town-issued stop work order posted at the site was cut down. The trustees failed to get fire safety and building permits for the gas tanks and travel plaza construction, or at least failed to get it from them. The town said that posed a danger to the health and safety of the town's residents and environment. Additionally, the suit said failure to obtain the necessary approval and permitting regarding the building and fire codes, property access, parking, lighting, drainage, public utilities, and noise impacts risks irreparable environmental and community harm. It's funny to see what it takes to get local governments to care about the environment. Shinnecock trustees' unauthorized construction of the travel plaza has increased traffic congestion, noise pollution, and debris on the local roads, not designed to accommodate heavy equipment of an increased load, the suit says. The Shinnecock Nation leaders have said they don't need the town's okay to go through with the project. They regard the plot, which is part of an 80-acre parcel referred to as Westwoods, as sovereign land outside the jurisdiction of state and local laws. Brian Polite, former Shinnecock chairman, mentioned this to Newsday earlier this year. And the lawsuit, though, claims, Southampton lawyers, referenced two land sales of the Westwoods property. One from the tribe's Sachem Wyandanch to the European settler John Ogden on May 12th, 1659. And another in April 1662 by tribal leader Weenie Sunk Squaw to settler Thomas Topping. They said the tribe did not use the land from the 17th to the 18th century. Because the nation's Aboriginal title to the Westwoods parcel has been extinguished, the nation cannot claim sovereignty over Westwoods to avoid compliance with applicable state and local law. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know a whole lot, but I do think that if the spine of your defense is to refer back to quote-unquote sales from Native Americans to European settlers back in the 1600s, you might not be on the firmest legal grounds, certainly not on the firmest moral grounds. And if you had doubts about the merits of the Shinnecock tribe's case here, reading that, I think reading that would convince you that, yeah, this... this stinks. This does not feel right. Well, whatever they come back with, we'll respond to that in a way that best addresses what the nation needs to do, said a spokesperson. We have to wait and see now. The vote was obviously taken by the town board, and there were quite a number of Shinnecock people who spoke against it. Yeah, so that's what's happening here on Long Island. Oh yeah, and you know, in a totally different arena here, Nassau County, you know, the county to the west, which is becoming increasingly right wing and filled with racism and anti trans. Yeah, I don't want to even get into that. But they're also the only county that voted against congestion pricing, which is set to take effect in a couple of weeks, actually, in January. Nassau state judge gave state officials until January 16th to respond to Hempstead Town, which is in Nassau County, Hempstead Town's lawsuit challenging the MTA's congestion pricing plan, but that's more than a week after the program is set to start, which is considered a setback to both Hempstead and Nassau County. Nassau Supreme Court Judge Lisa Cairo Monday ordered lawyers for the MTA and Governor Kathy Hochul to file defense arguments by January 16th. The deadline effectively ends the possibility of the Nassau court blocking the plan before its implementation, planned for January 5th. The MTA that day is set to start charging passenger vehicles $9 to enter Lower Manhattan below 60th Street. Less if you take the Midtown Tunnel. They will deduct a certain amount. It's unbelievable to me how a relatively small number of people are able to make such a big deal over what is really not that much money. $9. And if it is a big deal, you know, how much does your car cost? How much does parking cost? You know, the whole thing is completely absurd. The Nassau order comes the day after the MTA cleared other legal barriers to congestion pricing. On Monday, federal courts in Manhattan and White Plains denied requests to temporarily block the plan from taking effect. In separate cases brought by a citizens group, unions representing truckers and teachers, Orange and Rockland counties. It's pretty insane. According to Gordon Tepper, a spokesman for Hochul, said yesterday the governor will not be lectured by people who, particularly Supervisor Clavin from Hempstead, a Republican, who basically just hit Hempstead with a double-digit tax hike. Yeah, that's Republicans for you. Donald Clavin Jr. Basically hiked the property tax levy by 12.1%. Tepper said nearly 90% of commuters to Manhattan's central business district rely on public transit. 90%. And this congestion reduction plan will deliver $15 billion to ensure better, faster transit for millions of working New Yorkers. It's a no-brainer. A no-brainer. And we will see the benefits of that hopefully fairly soon. We get past all the nonsense. Okay, you know what? Speaking of nonsense being finished, we're about finished. You can write to us, OTW at 2600.com, OTW for Off the Wall. Captain Phil is coming up next on this special Christmas Eve night of programming. I'm sorry if we weren't as festive as we could have been. One thing that we do get a lot of feedback, though, about is the fact that we don't play nearly enough Estonian music on this radio show, and I'm sorry for that. Don't really have an excuse. But we're going to try to rectify that now with the Eurovision 2024 entry. Until then, well, I didn't say when. Until next week, yes. We'll be back next week. Until then, have yourselves a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you on the last day of the year. Good night, everyone.
Me pole narko, me pole narkomaani, pole midagi teinud. Kleidid meie seljas on prügikasti leid. Politsei kroonika ja suvilas on reid. Ainus kott, mis näha täis pandi pudeleid. Me pole narkomaani, pole midagi teinud. Kleidid meie seljas on prügikasti leid. Politsei kroonika ja suvilas on reid. Vormis mehed külas, mul on väga okei.
This is Vicki Peterson from the Bengals. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. You clever person, you.